The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
I would have said that it was Nancy Reagan. His best friend was Nancy Reagan. Right? No, that's not his best friend. The man he said his best friend was his best friend will blow your mind. And shows you how far we have come as a nation in the wrong direction. We have that coming up in just a second. Some amazing stuff on Ronald Reagan that I've never heard before. We have that. Also, the New York Times has labeled salads racist. A salad racist. Also, amazing technology on artificial intelligence speech generators has all kinds of ramifications. And I'm reading this yesterday just for my own personal entertainment. And then I listen to the speech generator and I can't believe what I'm hearing. They can make the president, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama say pretty much anything. Now remember, this is version one, but it's pretty darn incredible. Also, woman goes out, she buys a bedroom set, yard sale, something that never has happened to me, never will. It's always, you read about these stories and you're like, this can't be true. Woman goes out to a yard sale, she buys herself a bedroom set. She starts going through the bedroom set. We'll give you the whole story coming up in a minute. Guess what she finds? An original handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence. She's in Houston. And a story of another woman, a reporter in Georgia, who has had her world turned absolutely upside down, all for political correctness. We're going to begin there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Valerie Hoff, who we wanted to have on the program today, but her father is very, very ill, and she has asked that we come back to her later. So I don't know if we will, because this is a small story, but I think an important story, and we pray for her father. She is a veteran 11 Alive reporter. Tonight on 11 Alive, she jokingly used the N-word with the version with the A at the end. I can't believe we have to. That word, you watch Netflix, you watch anything, you listen to music, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And if you're cool enough, if you're the right person, if you're black, you could certainly use it. But boy, if you're white, you better not use that. So she used that word in a private message to a black man on Twitter that he went and publicized. Now listen to this story. Here's what she said. I was quoting something the gentleman had said in public tweet back to him in private, but it doesn't make it any less offensive, she wrote. I was incredibly stupid and reckless. I was in the middle of a pressure-filled day trying to chase down the video of a man being beaten and kicked by two Gwinnett police officers, which this particular gentleman had posted on Twitter. I immediately apologized, and I continue to do so. And I have offered my resignation to be effective immediately. So what has she done? What has she done? Well, first of all, something really bad. Let me just tell you what 11 Alive, the general manager said. 11 Alive does not tolerate any form of racial insensitivity and aggressively enforces our standard policies. We acted promptly to address this situation. Valerie Hoff has chosen to resign and apologizes for her actions. 11 Alive is committed to treating the communities we serve with dignity and respect. And we don't think calling ourselves 11 Alive is demeaning to you at all. I look forward to being a stay-at-home mom, she says. I'm going to work on my food and travel blog.
I mean, at least five alive would rhyme. What does 11 alive even mean? Why is it 11 alive? That's driving me crazy right
now. Because everyone on the station is alive.
There's 11 of us. Not on camera. There's only four of us, or sometimes mainly two of us. But then we add the sports guy, and if you count the weather guy, there's four of us. But you forget all the camera and lighting people. 11 alive.
There are dead people on some of our competing stations.
Unlike our competitors. Our hearts are beating.
All right. So here's what happened. Here's what happened. The man who identified himself as Curtis Rivers had posted a video of a white police officer punching a black motorist on his Twitter feed. This reporter, Valerie Hoff, was trying to get permission to use it for a breaking news story. On Twitter, Rivers had noted publicly that a lot of news N-words with an A were trying to track him down for the video. It's a word he uses a lot, apparently, on his Twitter feed, but it's totally fine for him.
Mm-hmm.
In response to a private direct message, Hoff called herself, I'm one of those, quote, news N-words. At first, he wrote LMFAOO, which I, what is that?
Laughing my A off. Yeah.
But there's another O. Outstanding.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right.
It's the same logic.
LMFAOO. But then he realized that she was white. So he responds. But then he checks into Valerie Hoff at 11 alive and realizes she's white. He then says, why are you calling me that? She explains she wasn't calling him. She referred to her.
And he knows that.
Yes, he does.
He knows that.
That's why he was LMFAOO.
Right.
Okay. She explained that she was referring to herself and quickly apologized. Rivers said when he figured out she was not black, he became offended. I just didn't think
Who's basing this on skin color? When I figured out she was not black, I became offended. Who is basing this incident on skin color here?
Just
her or him?
Your photos and realized you aren't
black. All she did was quote back to him what he called her, a news N-word. Yeah, I'm one of those news N-words. And now all of a sudden it's a federal offense and she's got to be fired for it. And make no mistake, she was forced out. She didn't just, oh, okay, I'll resign. Yeah, after they told her to resign.
I can guarantee you any rational human being.
Unbelievable.
When they were called into the office or they started to realize that their boss was not going to stand with them, any rational human being was going, wait, hold it just a second. First of all, I'm doing your bidding. You're putting pressure on me to get the video. Second of all, I'm using his language. I am trying to approach him in a way he will understand, and it obviously worked because he laughed. And so I was going to get it until he was racist and noticed that I was white.
It's unreal. Not to mention, her goal here was to put a video on television showing a white cop punching a black person.
Yeah, so she's so racist.
She's so
racist.
She
wants to uncover that.
Unreal.
He said, I just think it wasn't right for her to use that word in regards to a person who is an African-American. No, you're an N-word. You call yourself an N-word. Why all of a sudden, when this is called up into question, you're no longer, you and your buddies, the N-word. Now you're an African-American.
And obviously you're not calling him that. He's calling himself that.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
which
you're
is
right.
What you're pointing out.
Yeah, go ahead. Do all the legal stuff because there are people. No, I'm being serious with you because there are people in this audience like Rivers who will be offended that I have an opinion about this man being a racist. And they will be very upset that he can call himself that and all of his friends that, but as soon as he wants some respect, He refers to himself and others as African Americans. I'm sorry. I really don't understand this line, other than it is a trap that people set to make a point. That's all they're doing. You're setting a trap. You either live by it or you don't. I'm sorry, but we all know do as I say, not as I do is bullcrap. We knew it was wrong when our parents told us that. We knew it was wrong. We know it's wrong when our president does it. Well, I was just doing that. I would know a kid shouldn't do that. Really? Kids shouldn't do that? Well, thank you very much. Do as I say, not as I do.
And obviously, we sit here and we talk about racism a lot. It can be very serious at times, and it is serious at times. But the issue here that really makes it serious is intent, right?
Intent.
If you look at the story, she's trying to expose an issue that could potentially have racial implications to support the African American cause. She's going to someone to put that on the news. She's trying to expose these things.
If my assistant, Michelle, who is black, would come in to me in the morning and she would go, "What's up, my honky?" We would laugh.
Yeah.
We'd have absolutely no problem. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't say, "Oh my gosh, Michelle, how dare you say that? No, you're black. How dare you call me a honky? I'm an Anglo-Saxon." how dare you? I wouldn't.
Right.
Because
you know her intent.
Because I know her intent.
And you're believing the best about someone.
Correct. Now, a guy comes in and he's African American, and he walks in and he's like, "What's up, my honky?" I still am not offended. I think that's a little odd, but I'm still odd, not yes. offended. Now, if he follows it with, "You know what? It's honkies like you that are destroying the world and blah, 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 blah," then I know he's hostile.
Mm-hmm. And then you can judge him fairly based on
it. Correct.
Look, this is the exact opposite. Look at what we've done now. A guy writes chink in the armor. We assume the worst of him and assume he's making some sort of Asian slur. A guy on a tennis broadcast with Serena Williams, or was it Serena or Venus? I can't remember. But they're playing tennis, and he says these are guerrilla tactics. Guerrilla, G-U-E-R-R-I-L-L-A. He gets fired even though his employer, ESPN, says they understand. He wasn't saying G-O-R-I-L-L-A. He wasn't calling her a gorilla. So his intent wasn't there, and they knew he said something else. But because some people on Twitter misunderstood the word and didn't understand it, they fired him anyway. Here is another situation where here's a woman who's actually in the act of doing the exact opposite of racism, trying to expose a racial incident that would support that cause theoretically, and she can't get the video. She's trying to sweet talk someone and use his language and make him laugh. She succeeds at doing that and still gets fired.
So here's the rest of my honky thing, because it goes right into that point. I would think it weird if some guy walked in and is like, "Hey, what's up, my honky?" However, if we were all standing around and all of us were joking and all of us were like, "What's up, my honky? Hey, my honky. What's up, my honky?" And we're calling each other honky, and a guy who's standing there observing the whole thing wants to get in and wants to just come on in and just be like, "Hey, I'm cool too. What's up, my honky?" We would all laugh. So it's not like her saying, "I'm an N-word,"
out of
without
nowhere.
Context.
Right.
She's standing
quoting
in
him.
A virtual crowd, a virtual crowd where everyone is using that language. And the guy says it's just these news N-words. And she's like, "What's up, my honky? I'm one of those news N-words." It's completely rational. There is absolutely no racism that is there, except he said, if she's bold enough to say that to me, being an African American, then I'm pretty sure this is the first time this isn't the first time she's used that word. May I just use another word? Witch! Witch! She's a witch!
She doesn't float. You're pretty sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she's a witch.
The fusion of entertainment and enlightenment.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
I'll tell you, the left is overplaying its hand, and it's very, very clear when you look at culture. And I'm going to show you a couple of things from some cultural references that art and culture lead. And art and culture, they're turning on the left and some of this craziness of political correctness. However, I'm going to play something from Bill Maher here, probably next break. But I want you to hear a couple of the questions that lead up to this. He still doesn't see the flawed logic here with Hillary Clinton and her loss. Now listen to this.
Real Time with Bill Maher and our sister network, HBO. Bill, good to see you. What do you make of Hillary Clinton's discussion about the reason she lost?
I don't think she's wrong. I don't know why she needs to be coming back. She had her turn and it didn't work out. I compared her to Bill Buckner. The ball rolled through her legs. Having said that, she's right about the letter. I don't understand why Director Comey didn't release both. You know, he seemed to be in a tough place. I get it. He had to say something he thought 11 days before the election. Why not say that and then also mention the stuff about Russia with Donald Trump? That seemed to be, to me, the fair way to handle it.
When Hillary Clinton was asked...
Until the Democrats can get a handle on why Hillary Clinton lost, they will never be able to make this step forward to being in step with the American people. And I know a lot of people that are Democrats that don't want to admit this, but I also know the vast majority of Democrats that I know do admit this. She was an awful candidate. She was an awful candidate. She wasn't warm. She's not likable. She's got baggage like nobody has. Like Paris Hilton actual baggage for an overnight stay, which has got to be 100 Louis Vuitton suitcases and trunks. She's got baggage. People don't trust her and they don't like her. That's why she lost. The Clintons overplayed their hand between the foundation, which people have questions about. I don't know if it's dirty or not, but man, I got some real questions. What happened to all that money in Haiti? What'd you do with that? Then Benghazi, all the way back through the 90s, they have Clinton fatigue. But that's not what he believes. And I want you to hear his sexism charge and then where he takes on the Democrats and the left. And I want to show you a couple of other pieces from culture when we come back.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Hello, America. So, Bill Maher is on CNN and he's talking to Jake Tapper and he says, you know, they're talking about Hillary Clinton coming out again and whining about why she lost and not having any self-awareness at all. I suck. Nobody likes me. They like me because of Bill. But if Bill wasn't around, I would never have been a politician or anything that had gone above possibly a mayor.
That would be woke Hillary.
That would be woke Hillary.
But she's not.
But she's not woke.
No.
So she is, nobody around her has enough courage to say, Hillary, you're going to let this go, baby. Because You played a role in this. Nobody likes you. And you've just overstayed your welcome. And if, I mean, honestly, we've said this from the beginning, my shoe could have beaten Hillary Clinton. And I think that was proven out with Donald Trump. Somebody that even most people on the right will say, I mean, I found it really hard to vote for the guy, but I can't go for Hillary. I mean, that's basically saying, I've got a shoe, and, well, my shoe isn't Hillary. A lot of what happened here was you had two of the most flawed candidates in American history running against each other, and it was a Sophie's choice in the negative. You wanted to put them both on the train, but you had to select one that stayed with you. And that's what it was. I want this one to go away, and I don't want to see them again. And that's the way everybody on the left felt about Donald Trump. I'd like to put him on the train, and I never want to think about him again. So she's not self-aware enough to see it's just time to go away, Hillary. It's time to go away. You had your chance. You blew it. And until people can be honest and say, look, she was a really flawed candidate, they won't be able to move forward. Now, listen to what Bill Maher says. This is fascinating.
When Hillary Clinton was asked at the event if misogyny played a role in her loss, she said, yes. Do you agree?
Of course, absolutely. I think we learned a lot about this country, and we're learning more about it as we watch what goes on with Fox News every day.
That is a pretty remarkable turn of events, but you think that that's about a misogynistic problem in American corporate culture and not just a few bad apples, I'm guessing.
Not just corporate culture. You know, I think race is more on the surface, and people talk about it, and there's movements like Black Lives Matter, and I'm glad there are. But I think we thought we were further along on the woman issue than we are, and I don't think we are.
Stop for a second. I want to point this out that, okay, maybe we aren't as far as I thought we were with women, because we're not as far along as I thought we were on things like the Constitution. You know, we're not as far along as I thought we were on our principles that bring us together. We're not as far along as I thought we were on anger issues and identity politics. I thought that was one side, but it is also the other side. It's our side too. So maybe he's right, but I don't about some of that. That, you know, maybe we're not as far along as I think we are. However, to condemn America as this blind country, this jingoistic, blind, race-hating, Muslim-hating country, you have a guy who grew up in outside of America, has the name, chosen name, of Barack Hussein Obama, while we're fighting a guy named Hussein
and Osama,
who is black. Now, when, you know, has the Prime Minister of England been black? Has the Prime Minister of Italy, Germany, France, let's use some of their countries, Cuba, Russia, China, have they had black guys? No.
Mm-mm.
Okay, so here's a country that not only elected a black man, and even his most vocal foes, me, when he was elected, the very next day I got on and said, let's just take a minute here and just celebrate the fact that we're not who everybody says we are. I'm thrilled that barrier is now gone. I'd be thrilled for the barrier, for a woman to be president. Oh, who thinks that way? Who thinks that way?
Your chosen candidate. The vice president of that ticket was Carly Fiorina.
Yes.
Right? Yes. I mean, that was the one you were rooting for.
Yes. I mean, you just don't think this. You don't think this way. I don't think the vast majority. Now, some do. Okay, but there's always a group of people in any size group that have weird beliefs or wrong beliefs on something. But now listen to what he says. Do you have the rest?
I mean, there's something like 80 countries who have had a woman leader. Pakistan has had a woman leader. But the not the United States of us. Somehow we lag behind that. And I know a lot of people say, yes, I'd vote for a woman. I just didn't want to vote for that one.
Hold on just a second. Have they had a Christian leader? Have they had a Jewish leader? Has Pakistan had a white leader? Have they had an Indian leader? I just want to throw out. A Jewish leader. This is our world. That's their world. Well, they've had a woman leader. Okay, they've had a woman leader.
We've never had a Pakistani leader, but Pakistan has.
Right. You're not comparing. It's culture to culture, dude. Culture to culture. Now listen, there's more.
Well, let's see next time when there's another woman put up for president. And I don't know how. Carly I don't know Fiorina. When that's going to happen. It doesn't look like anytime soon.
Carly Fiorina.
Well, it might be Elizabeth Warren. We don't know. Well, let me ask you.
Stop. Instead of Carly Fiorina, it might be Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren, another person that even people on the not hard left, but on the Democratic side say is too hardcore left.
Mm-hmm. So it's Bernie Sanders, but you know.
Bernie Sanders, who's a woman and younger. But there's a lot of people that think Bernie Sanders is too far. Go ahead.
Any of the 2020 possibilities, any Democrats that you like, that you hope get into the race?
Listen to the sexist.
I still like Bernie Sanders.
Okay, stop. What an unbelievable sexist.
Everybody all else that. Is a misogynist, but he still wants Bernie Sanders.
Now, if there was a race between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, who was he pushing for?
What a misogynist.
Was he pushing for the old white guy? Was he pushing for Hillary Clinton because he's not a misogynist?
No, so he is awesome. A misogynist. He pushed for the old white guy.
It's amazing. Yeah,
that is awesome.
Absolutely is truly amazing.
Complete unawareness, too.
Yeah.
They are so self-unaware. It's
okay.
By the way, so, Bernie's only 8 years older than Elizabeth Warren. So let's not, I think you'd have a very similar profile there.
I'm just saying the old white guy. I mean, but I'm tired of the old white guy.
I'm just saying the age isn't too much of a factor.
Oh, my gosh. Stu, why are you?
You said, but younger. You hate, and it's not. Yes, technically.
8 years.
Yeah, 8 years.
And why are you always defending the old white guys? You just want a culture full of old white guys that's started by old
He's
white guys.
What candidate would you like if you had a choice of any candidate?
I would like, I don't know if you have met Raji Hussein Mao.
Mm-hmm.
But
I haven't.
It is a wonderful unit. I don't want to say person,
okay, sure, of course
and
not.
I'm not going to assign gender, but that's that's the one that I think if America wants to prove itself and redeem itself, it will vote for that.
Okay, good. Okay.
Okay. So there you go. Now there's more because what I want to show you is they're overplaying their hand. While they're overplaying their hand, they are saying they're overplaying their hand. Do you have the other piece from Bill Maher? Mm-hmm. Now listen to this.
So what should Democrats do to win over Trump voters?
Well, I was just going to say, a bit of it should be ease up on the identity politics.
Okay. Identity politics. And then he's saying we should ease up on it. Now, when we come back, I'm going to show you culturally comedy, television shows, art, that always leads the way. It always, when you start to see art going a certain way, and I use art to cover a lot of things, you see culture start to move. Culture is always ahead of politics. And I want to show you a couple of things that show, again, the culture is being moved away from the identity politics, all of the political correctness, all of the things that you could be woken up in the middle of the night and ask a question. You went, what? What are you talking about? Go back to sleep. You're not making any sense. You, in a dead sleep, could be able to say, you who are supposedly awake aren't making any sense. Go to sleep. They're overplaying their hand, and the culture is starting to change.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
All right. I want to show you a couple of, and can you set these up, Stu? These are two pieces from two separate TV shows.
Yeah.
And I just want to show you, culture always leads. The Democrats overplaying their hands? Oh, yes, they are. Listen to this. First clip is...
The Birthday Boys sketch comedy, IFC, is the channel it's on.
Listen to this.
Hi, folks. I wanted to take a moment to call your attention to something I find quite interesting that's been evolving in our society. If you haven't noticed, the concept of what makes a family has changed quite a bit in the 21st century. Maybe it's not what you're used to, but sometimes a family doesn't have to be a mom, a dad, two kids, a dog, and a house in the suburbs. The contemporary family can include a stepmother or stepfather. Sometimes there are two moms or two dads. A family can be several children and a loving aunt or uncle. A family can also be a grandmother, her grandkids, and a helpful nanny. A family can be 10 dads. That's it, just 10 dads with no kids. A family can also be 10 kids with not one dad between the lot of them. A family can be one kid, all by himself, alone in the woods. Or maybe a family does have a mom, a dad, and two kids, but take a closer look at that dad. He's a woman. Let's say you got 30 kids, a Hyundai Elantra, and 3 quarts of milk. That's a family. A fat guy, a watermelon, and a stack of magazines? Family. How about a collection of people who may look very much like a family, but I promise are of no relation whatsoever? Guess what? I lied. That's a family. Sue me. Or maybe you got a family, but then they get all jumbled up with some other family. Family. Picture, if you will, the entire population of Rhode Island. Now picture their Thanksgiving. Let's take another look at this family whose dad turned out to be a woman. There's still something fishy about them, isn't there? Maybe it's that mom. Wait a second. That's no woman. That's a magazine. A Jew, a Catholic, and a Muslim walk into a bar.
Right, there's one sketch comedy. We've played for you several comedians.
Chappelle, Jim Norton, who's the other one? No, we didn't play. Louis C.K. was on something
else. Yeah, we
didn't
play Louis C.K.
There was...
But, I mean, they're all moving in the same direction. Now, listen to this. What is this one from?
This one is from Portlandia.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Carrie.
This year for National Coming Out Day, we want people to know that coming out is for everyone.
There are lots of options for coming out, and we're here to help you find a sexuality that works for you.
Hi, Tom here, and I'm heteroplausible. I'm not straight, but just to appease my parents, I tell them I could be, who knows?
I'm married. I can't wait to break up with a guy I'm dating and start dating women. I'm a homosexual. Next up,
Hi, I'm Daniel. I'm homological. Do the math. I should be gay, but I'm not. Too much belly fat.
I'm Charlotte. I'm a homo spectacle. I'll totally kiss another woman to get the attention of men. I've met a lot of boyfriends this way.
Hello, I'm Neil. I'm heterospeculative. I'm into guys, but, you know, those ladies.
Hi, I'm Connie, and I want to let everyone know that I'm a hobosexual. I am really, really into hobos. Call me. I probably don't have a phone, so I'm going to come find you.
Hi, I'm Rick. I'm homotextual. A couple of same-sex flirty text messages didn't hurt anybody. And guess what? My wife's kind of cool with it.
I'm homocasual.
May I just point out that when the culture starts to say these things and the universities... and the politicians and the so-called civil rights leaders are all saying these things seriously, you're in trouble. Do you hear any of these things about climate change? Nope. Nope. They still take that very seriously. gender. Families can be, you know, a shoebox, a magazine, and a watermelon. They're starting to overplay their hand. And, I mean, if they want to keep their heads buried in the sand, great. But it's good news for people who believe in common sense. The culture is beginning to turn.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Who's Ronald Reagan's best friend? This is an amazing story that you've never ever heard. You're going to learn a few things about Ronald Reagan in the next few minutes that I just find fascinating. From Paul Kangor, a good friend of the program and a great historical writer. Also, we need to tell you about, did you hear about the couple that sold their piano to a music school in England? And then they had the piano tuner come in and he just couldn't get the darn thing to stay in key. And he's like, there's something behind here that's stopping. He opens up the back, and hidden in the piano are 150-year-old gold coins, bags full of them, hidden in this piano.
Jeez.
We're also going to tell you, if you didn't hear that, I'll tell you that. But there's also a Rockton woman who found, she bought at a tag sale or a yard sale, she found a bedroom set from the 1920s. People are just selling it. She's like, I like it. She gets it home. She opens it up. And there, rolled up in the back of it, is an original handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence. She didn't believe it until she brought it to an appraiser. And the appraiser was like, I've never seen one like this and this good of condition. It's pristine.
Wow.
We have to tell you about that. But first, Ronald Reagan, like perhaps you've never seen him before, beginning right now.
The fusion of entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program. Yeah.
Paul Kangor, professor at Grove City College, author of numerous books. He has a new one out about Ronald Reagan, the extraordinary untold story of the 20th century. I don't want to tell you the name of the book because it will spoil the surprise. I would have thought the best friend, that somebody that Ronald Reagan would say is my best friend, would be Nancy. That's not what Paul found. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, Glenn, thanks so much.
So, how did you find this about Ronald Reagan? Where did you find this? And were you shocked by it? Not shocked, but just so shocked that you didn't know it.
Yeah, I'd say both, really. And in fact, Nancy Reagan, and here's the giveaway, said that John Paul II was her husband's closest friend, which is an amazing thing to say. So you had Ronald Reagan referring to John Paul II as his best friend. And then Nancy said that John Paul II was her husband's closest friend.
Isn't that amazing? I've never heard that, never
right.
known that. That in many ways, that completely changes my view in a positive way of Ronald Reagan and who he was. To be John Paul's closest and best friend is remarkable.
It is. And I think, look, to be sure, I think there's probably a little bit of a kind of genial overstatement, right, on the part of Reagan in saying that. But the first time that I heard it, it was about 10 years ago. And somebody from the Polish Solidarity Movement told me about him and three other members of the Polish Solidarity Movement. They were visiting with Reagan. This would have been the spring of 1989. And Reagan was no longer president. He was at his Century City office. They were about to hold these historic elections in Poland that would really take, I mean, that's what really took down the communist bloc, those elections in Poland, even before the Berlin Wall fell. And he said, you won't believe this conversation. We're talking to Reagan, the old campaigner who won 49 out of 50 states. And we asked him for some campaign advice. And he looked at us and he said, listen to your conscience, because that's where the Holy Spirit speaks to you. What was that? And they gave him a sort of puzzled look. And then he turned and he gestured to a picture on his office wall of Pope John Paul II. And he said, he's my best friend. He said, yes, you know, I'm Protestant. He's obviously Catholic, but he's my best friend. And when I started asking people about this, including Nancy Reagan, who was great, every time I had a question for Nancy, I usually sent it by email or phone call, and she would respond to all of these. She was wonderful because she loved John Paul II herself. She said that John Paul II was her favorite leader among everybody that Ronnie met with. And I think, Glenn, what they both mean by that is it's not like the two were calling each other up and talking about the ball game or going fishing. But I think what Reagan meant was, in terms of this kind of historical and spiritual, he and John Paul II both saw it this way, this historical spiritual struggle to take down and defeat this evil empire, atheistic Soviet communism. Reagan felt that there was no better friend or no closer friend than he had in that endeavor than Pope John Paul II.
We're talking to Dr. Paul Kangor, a professor and a great author, written several books. One of them is that he did with Mercury, Inc., The Communist, which was about Barack Obama's mentor, Frank Marshall Davis. Great researcher on history. His new book is A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Paul, they had this connection of not only bringing things down, but I think they also had, and you talk about it in the book, this connection because they both felt that they were men of destiny, and they both had an assassination attempt against them, and they both survived, which I think hardened that man of destiny, we're on God's side kind of feeling.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, people forget this now. Everybody remembers that they were both shot, but I mean, they were shot only 6 weeks apart. It was March 30th, 1981 that Reagan was shot by John Hinckley. And then John Paul II was shot on May 13th, 1981. And immediately after Reagan was shot, the Pope sent his prayers to Reagan, you know, wishing him well for a speedy recovery. And then Reagan, right after John Paul II was shot, immediately tried to call the Vatican. He called Cardinal Cook, Cardinal Kroll in New York and Philadelphia, sent a letter off to the Pope saying that he was horrified by this, telling him that he was praying for him. Had a personal letter delivered to him by Congressman Peter Rodino, a Democrat from New Jersey, had it taken all the way to Rome. And I mean, they already had wanted to meet with each other, Glenn, at least since early 1981 when Reagan was president. And actually for Reagan, he wanted to meet with John Paul II from the moment that he saw footage of the Pope going to his homeland in June 1979. Mm. Reagan said, we got to get elected and we got to reach out to him and the Vatican and make them an ally. So now with the two of them being shot, and people didn't know this then either, they both very nearly bled to death.
Right.
I mean, they should have died. The Pope needed six pints transfused of blood. Yeah. Reagan needed eight. They both should have bled to death on their respective ways to the hospital. And then when they finally got together for the first time at the Vatican in June 1982, they met for about an hour alone, and they confided to one another their mutual beliefs that they believed that God had spared their lives for a special purpose to take down atheistic Soviet communism.
Mm. Talking to Paul Kangor, Paul, this is, I think, new. I've never heard this before, that the Reagan being shot may have prevented the Soviet Union from invading Poland. Is that true?
Right. It's incredible. It's an incredible story. It was told to me by someone who was at the Berlin station at the time in late 70s and early 1980s. And I first heard this about 5 years ago. And I was blown away by the possibility. I spent a summer at the Reagan Library looking into this, and it pretty much checks out. And here's what we know. Between about November 1980 and the time that the Soviets helped declare martial law in Poland, this would have been December 1981, everybody was on pins and needles that the Soviet Union was going to invade Poland. I mean, we thought it was possible. We're hoping it wouldn't happen. Thought it was possible. I was told by my source that he said, "You have no idea how close this was." He was decrypting information from the Soviets throughout March 1981, and he said that he had information that they were literally ready to march into Poland on March 30th, 1981. On that exact date, March 30th, 1981. And he said, well, why is that so profound? Because, of course, Reagan was shot on March 30th, 1981. Mm-hmm. And he claims that because Reagan was shot and the U.S. military went on full nuclear alert, highest level of DEFCON,
wow.
Al Haig, you know, stomped into the White House, said, "I'm in charge here." And it's funny because everybody made fun of Haig for that. But the Soviets saw that. And they said, Al Haig, you know, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, he's no one to mess around with. And they
wow.
saw the DEFCON alert. And my source told me they were ready to go. And then when Reagan was shot, that's what called off the whole thing.
Wow.
So, I think it's
accurate.
Let me go back to the assassination on the Pope. You have in your book new details that the KGB was involved in the Pope's assassination.
That's right. And we've long suspected that the Soviets were involved. John Paul II, Glenn, thought it as early as basically July 1981. In fact, when he got to the hospital before he passed out, he said to the nurse, "How could they do it? How could they do it?" You know, they meaning who? The one guy that lifted his gun, Mehmet Asha, and shot him? I mean, he suspected right away that something was going on. He was telling people by late 81, his aides and confidants, that he thought that Moscow ordered it. Reagan, Bill Casey at the CIA, Casey called a very tight meeting of the National Foreign Intelligence Board on F Street in Washington the very next morning, May 14th, wanted to know what Moscow was up to. Bill Clark of the National Security Council. So they all suspected Moscow. Then when word got out that the Bulgarians were involved, and you and Pat and Stu, knowing your Cold War history, I mean, you know what the Bulgarians were like. I mean, they were stooges of the Soviet Union. Some people called Bulgaria the 16th Soviet Republic. So when they heard that Bulgaria was involved and was behind Mehmet Asha, that immediately raised red flags, pun intended. And you know, they when they heard Bulgaria, they thought, okay, Moscow had to have been involved. But they kept all of this quiet until Casey ordered a truly super secret investigation at the CIA. And this is really the kind of the blockbuster thing that I've broken in this book. And Casey, this was a very tight investigation. I was told it was spearheaded by two young women, one of them in her late 20s, early 30s, another in her early 40s. And they came to the conclusion that Moscow did, in fact, order the hit on the Pope. And specifically, it was through the Soviet GRU, military intelligence. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that organized it. But they did it with the go-ahead and the approval of Yuri Andropov at the KGB.
How much, and I'm trying to think of the timing here, I think it was after the assassination. How much did this play a role in Ronald Reagan having zero doubt or fear of labeling the Soviet Union an evil empire?
Well, that's a good question. Reagan said that in March of 83.
Right.
And I think for Reagan, I mean, he always knew they were evil. He had been calling them evil, monsters.
But I mean, if you knew that they were evil, but even the Pope said, how could they do this? To go and try to assassinate the Pope in a guy who sees a black and white world already, that just pushes you into a whole new level of evil.
That's right. It really does. And I mean, it doesn't surprise me, knowing the way that the Soviet Union, they had been killing priests and bishops, right. Russian Orthodox Church, rabbis, Roman Catholic priests, Protestant priests. They've been doing this since 1917. I mean, they killed hundreds, if not thousands. They were blowing up churches. Reagan knew that history. John Paul II knew it from being in Poland, where they harassed him since about the 1950s. So really, I think kind of the answer to your question, Glenn, whereas a lot of the establishmentarians in the State Department and the CIA couldn't imagine that the Soviets would descend to that level, Reagan and Bill Casey and John Paul II and guys like Bill Clark, they had no problem at all imagining the Soviets.
I want to come back with you and talk to you. We're talking to Paul Kangor. His new book out is A Pope and a President. You get into something that I wasn't aware of, and maybe others are, that the Pope was a big scholar or a big fan, I don't know how you would describe it, of the secrets of Fatima. Which I would like you to describe what those secrets of Fatima are, how the Vatican has the last parts of the secrets of Fatima. Did Reagan know any of that? And the role that those secrets played with Russia, something that nobody would have wanted to know about the president at the time. The press would have had a field day with that. But I'd like to hear about his connections with the secrets of Fatima and the Pope coming up in just a second. The name of the book, again, is A Pope and a President. Fascinating and new material on Ronald Reagan and the Pope. Sponsor this half hour is My Patriot Supply. Yesterday, two USB-1 bombers departed Anderson Air Force Base in Guam, and they conducted a joint drill with South Korea and Japan. They flew over the North Korean peninsula, and they flew close to the 39th parallel. Why? The reason why is they showed off our stealth and our B-1 bombers, saying to North Korea, they flew close enough to the zone for them to know what they were, to say, we can knock out all of your infrastructure.
Does the 39th parallel scare them as much as the 38th
does? I'm sorry, the 38th parallel. Thank you. No, it doesn't.
Okay.
It doesn't. Okay, right. Thank you.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
We're talking to Dr. Paul Kangor, great friend of the show and a great, brilliant historian and writer. A Pope and a President is his new book. And before we move into the secrets of Fatima, Paul, I want to go back to what you said about the Soviets planning on invading Poland the day of Ronald Reagan's shooting. And if it wasn't that Ronald Reagan was shot that day, they were going to invade. A couple of things on that. If they would have invaded, even without Al Haig, America would have immediately assumed it was the Soviet Union that was behind this assassination attempt, which would have been false. But we would have immediately assumed that that was not a coincidence. And
that's right.
And even if it wasn't for the shooting, if they would have invaded, we may have gone to nuclear war over that.
That's right. Yeah, that would have been absolutely and utterly devastating. And I think one of the reasons why they pulled back, Glenn, is because people might have linked it to the shooting,
sure.
to the shooting of Reagan. I mean, it turns out, of course, it was John Hinckley, and he was just trying to get the attention of Jody Foster. He wasn't involved in any international conspiracy whatsoever. But people would have definitely thought of that. And something I think that's even more profound on a spiritual level about this.
Stand by, Reagan, stand by, stand by, stand by.
Sure.
Hold on to that. We have to take a quick break. We'll come back, get that profound spiritual thing, which will lead us into Ronald Reagan, the Pope, Russia, and the secrets of Fatima, which are phenomenal. But to hear the connection with Ronald Reagan is doubly phenomenal. Back with Paul Kangor next.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. We're back with Dr. Paul Kangor, author of the new book, A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. We started with Ronald Reagan said his best friend was Pope John Paul. They had this incredibly tight relationship. We found out, and Paul's new book exposes the KGB, or I'm sorry, the Soviet plot to go into Poland the day that Ronald Reagan, you want to talk about divine destiny, the day that Ronald Reagan was shot, and they didn't go in because they knew that the world or America might say, my gosh, the Soviets shot Reagan, so they could go into Poland, and Al Haig steps up and says, I'm in charge, and they freaked out about that. So all of these things that we thought were so bad may have actually saved the world from a nuclear winter. Paul, you were saying there's a more, even more miraculous side to this?
Well, those words, divine destiny, Glenn. Okay. I mean, that's what nails it. You got it exactly right, and it's fascinating because Ronald Reagan always believed, and his mother, his very devout mother, had taught him this since he was a little boy. She said, "God has a plan for everything, Ronnie. All the bad things that are going to happen to you, God can bring good out of these bad things, especially if you're faithful." So he always believed that bad things happen for a good purpose. And I could show you dozens of letters. Reagan, as far back as the 1960s as governor, writing these nice, sweet letters to a widow who he read about in the newspaper who lost her husband because he was a policeman and he was shot. And Reagan would say things like, I know this is really hard, but God can bring good out of this. It was almost like this divine plan theology that he had. And so here, of all things, could it be that his near-death experience, you know, averted geopolitical catastrophe? And it's possible that it did. And what makes it even more intriguing, Glenn, is that Reagan never knew this, because you know, what I was told about this from the source in the book, we call him Jack, he shared this about 10 years ago. We believe that Bill Casey went over and talked to him about it in Field Station Berlin. But I don't know that Reagan ever knew that him taking that bullet might well have averted the Soviets from invading Poland.
You know, it's interesting because the left, you know, likes to make Ronald Reagan into a zealot when it's to their convenience, but they also will always throw up that he wasn't a religious man. He wasn't. And he doesn't strike me as a religious man, but he strikes me as a very devout man. A big believer in God, and I think his optimism comes from that same belief that I have, that, you know, yes, it could get bad, but it will be great on the other side. What strikes me as odd, knowing Ronald Reagan, the way history has portrayed him as this irreligious guy, is his fascination with Our Lady of Fatima and the Fatima secrets. First, for anybody who doesn't know that, can you explain what the secrets are and then Ronald Reagan's connection to them?
Sure. One of the reasons I love your show is that you're willing to talk about things like this. Most people aren't willing to go here, but I couldn't ignore it in the book. Look, John Paul II was shot on May 13th, 1981, which every Catholic knows is the feast day of Our Lady of Fatima. And I say very carefully in the book, you know, if you're not Catholic, you're probably going to find this very suspect. You might shrug it off, but you need to understand it, because John Paul II was totally motivated by this, and Reagan was fascinated by it. But they Catholics believe, and this has been an officially approved miracle and series of apparitions in the Catholic Church. There have been thousands of these claimed over the centuries, and the Church has only approved, I think, less than a dozen of them. But it is the belief that Mary, the Blessed Mother, appeared in this little Portugal village called Fatima between May 13, 1981, and October 1917, and October 13, 1917. And amid these appearances, the Lady of Fatima issued three predictions, and one of them was that World War I would end soon, but another war would start not that long after that, so World War II. The second was the rise of communism in Bolshevik Russia. And keep in mind, you know, that didn't break out until October of 1917, after all of her alleged appearances.
Right, and so you also know these kids were literally kids. They were like 7 and 8 years old in Portugal. They were not right. Worldly kids to come home, you know, a seven-year-old kid and go, oh, and the rise of Bolshevism and Russia is going to play a very big war, you know, geopolitically in the next 80 years. Bolsheviks, I mean, the revolution hadn't happened yet.
I know. Imagine that. And by the way, Pope Francis is going to canonize two of them in Portugal this coming May 13th.
Wow.
So two of the three kids are going to be made saints. So this is very serious.
What's wrong with the third kid? What's wrong with the
third kid? It was a smoking problem.
Well, that's a great question, Pat. And the third one, her name was Lucia.
Yeah.
She lived until 2005. She died just a couple months before John Paul II did. The two youngest children that are going to be canonized, they died within a couple years of these apparitions. And the lady had even said, two of you are going to be leaving here soon, but the other one, you will remain. And it was Lucia who remained for the entire rest of the century and recorded all of this stuff. So the second secret was the rise of communism in Bolshevik Russia, spreading errors and persecution against the faithful and the church around the world. Now, the third secret of Fatima, this was the one that people in the Catholic Church thought this predicted Armageddon. This would be the end of the world. This would be, you know, this was the apocalypse. Well, it turned out, and this is really dramatic, but it's true.
Hang on just a second. This one was not revealed. This one, I think, was given to the Pope, and the Pope kept it in the secret archives for a very long time, right?
That's right. That's right. They kept it in the archives, and a couple of previous popes, I think three of them had read it, decided that the time wasn't right to release it yet. And then John Paul II, when he was shot on May 13, 1981, then he recovered, and he started thinking to himself, 2/13 of May, 2/13 of May. And this was somebody who literally devoted his papacy to the intercession of Mary. His papal motto was Totus Tuus, which means totally yours, Mary. Mary was his intercessor for Jesus. And so he requested to see the third secret. It was brought to him at Gemelli Clinic, where he was recovering after the shooting on July 18th, 1981, and he opened it up, and the third secret talked about an attack on a bishop in white. The only bishop that wears white in the Catholic Church is the Pope. And in this attack, in this vision, the Pope goes down and is apparently killed in this vision. They tried to kill him. And with that, he connected the whole thing. He believed that the third secret of Fatima was about him, and thus that confirmed for him, long before it did for Ronald Reagan and Bill Casey, that the Russians were involved. All of this connected for him back to the Russians. And after pondering it for a while, he requested to see that third secret. He read it, and then on the anniversary of Fatima, 10 years later, he would actually take the bullet that had been in his body and put it in the crown of Our Lady of Fatima at the original Fatima site in Portugal.
Wow.
Now, I know a lot of people, again, if you're not Catholic, you're probably going to think, I don't know if I can believe that or whatever, but Ronald Reagan was fascinated by it. And Reagan received a literal full briefing on Fatima from Frank Shakespeare, the second ambassador to the Vatican, before another one-on-one meeting that Reagan had with John Paul II at the Vatican in June 1987. And Reagan actually went to Portugal, and I can't believe that no one paid attention to this, but Reagan gave a speech to the Portugal Assembly, Congress, May 9th, 1985, where he actually mentioned the children of Fatima, Mary, and John Paul II. It got no publicity. No one reported on it.
I will tell you that what is fascinating to me, and I keep saying this about the Middle East, it doesn't matter if you believe what these people believe.
That's right.
You need to understand that they believe it. I mean, it motivated Ronald Reagan. It motivated Pope John Paul. Doesn't matter if you believe it. It's the same with the people in Iran and the Middle East that believe in the caliphate and the war, and the return of the 12th Imam and everything. You could say all that's hogwash. Doesn't matter. It's right. What's motivating them.
That's key. That's what's key to people to understand. And also, Glenn, here's another entire fascinating component about this. Fatima was the only city in all of Portugal named for the daughter of Muhammad. Muhammad's favorite daughter was Fatima. And she is the second most revered person in Islam, or second most revered female in Islam, behind only the Virgin Mary. Mary is mentioned in the Quran more times than Jesus is mentioned in the Quran. And so of all things, there is this, and Mahmoud Ali Asha, who shot the Pope, was Muslim, a Muslim Turk. And when John Paul II went to meet with Asha to forgive him privately in the jail cell, he said, the thing that Asha was really freaked out about was what Asha kept referring to as this goddess of Fatima. He was calling her this goddess of Fatima. And he was afraid that she was going to wreak vengeance on him and, strike him with, a lightning bolt out of the sky or something.
Wow.
Yeah. So the Muslim world, what I'm telling you about Fatima and Mary wouldn't surprise people in the Muslim world. I've got friends who are Coptic Christians in the Middle East.
Yeah, that wouldn't.
They're not surprised by any of this at all.
Yeah.
This isn't strange for any of them.
Wasn't there supposed to be some sort of unrevealed portion of the third secret of Fatima?
Yeah, I thought
wasn't there
too.
Like a big, at least a rumor or a belief within the church that there was more to it. And then, in fact, I think it seems like Pope Benedict said something about that, that there is no more, right?
That's absolutely right, Pat. Yeah, the church spent a lot of time on that. They fully released it here again, May 13th, 2000. And the person who at that point was running the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which kept all of this stuff locked up for decades, was a cardinal by the name of Joseph Ratzinger, who wrote the whole secret, let it all loose, and later became Pope Benedict XVI, who replaced John Paul II.
And what was it they thought was there? Do you know? Do you know what the rest was supposed to be?
There was so much, I think, this sounds odd, but people who wanted the third secret to really be something more, like Armageddon, end times, the return of
Jesus. Yeah, because that's what
I want it to be that.
I don't either, but I remember I grew up in a Catholic school, and this is before the third secret, and that's what we always believed. And in fact, it was my belief that it was that they were saying that the Pope was going to be killed, Russia was going to have a new rise after the century, and that the Lord would have to return. I mean, it was right.
Which some people believe that all of that could still be possible as like a further fulfillment.
Sure.
But what the third secret says is, it predicted this attack on a bishop in white, and so it kind of ends there. And one of the reasons why some Catholics believe that Lucia lived as long as she did is that throughout this process, 80s, 90s, 2000s, all the way up until the release of the third secret, they were in regular communication with her saying, okay, is this it? Has it been fully revealed? And she kept saying, yes, this is it. It's been fully revealed. This is the end of it.
The name of the book is A Pope and a President by Paul Kangor. Make sure you pick it up. Fascinating stuff. And Paul, it is always great to have you on. You're one of my favorites in history. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks so much, guys. Always great to be on.
You bet. Paul Kangor, A Pope and a President. I went in to the secret archives at the Vatican, and I didn't find out how rare that was until I was standing next to the guy who ran the Catholic University and was the head of the university committee that would go and brief the Pope. He would have two advisors, one who was the head of the theological university and the other was the head of the archives. And when I was in the archives for the first 10 minutes, I said, this is unbelievable. I said, what is the meaning of this? And I turned to the guy of the theological school and he said, I don't know. I've never been allowed here. I've never been allowed past the first door. 3 hours later, we were still going through. It's phenomenal. But it's that kind of thing that makes people say, well, they got tons of secrets they're hiding. They got all kinds of stuff.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Yeah.
888-727-BECK.
Good morning this morning.
What a beautiful morning it is.
It is this morning. Good morning.
It's a little brisk outside this morning in Radioland.
Got some thunder bumpers coming a little later on this afternoon.
I want to bring an umbrella along for the ride.
Don't forget those rubbers.
Wait, what?
I think so. Thank you, Jeffy. All righty. Fumble to fumble. back with something more appropriate.
What was the...
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. The uniqueness of your voice is about to be gone. We have a couple of other amazing stories, one of them very dangerous. The Heritage Foundation has taken Jim DeMint out. And let's make no mistake, it is because the Heritage Foundation stood against Donald Trump's Trump Care. They could not go after the Freedom Caucus because we all focused on the Freedom Caucus. And so what did they do? They went after the Heritage Foundation. Make no mistake, the conservative base is under attack. Also, make no mistake, it was Jim DeMint and the Heritage Foundation that actually got our Supreme Court justice to be the man he is. If it wasn't for the Heritage Foundation, I'm not sure that Neil Gorsuch would have been the man. They have dumped Senator Jim DeMint out like a bag of garbage on the side of the street. Not good for the fighters of freedom. We have that and so much more. We're going to try to squeeze all of it in this hour. Let's get started right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Hello, America. Let me give you this first. This is one of those things that you always dream of happening to you, and it never happens to you. You know, you go to somebody's garage sale, and you're like, oh my gosh, I think that is a original. Yeah, and you find out it's heavy metal plastic. And it's worth half of what you paid at the garage sale. Anyway, that's the way it always happens to me. This woman near Chicago in Rockford, Illinois, she goes in and she buys this 1920s bedroom set. She goes in and she buys it and it's, delivered to her house and she's all excited. Look, I got such a great deal in this bedroom set. And then she starts going through the drawers and all of a sudden she sees something that's kind of tucked up in one of the drawers. And she pulls it out and unrolls it and thinks, this has got to be a fake, but boy, the paper even feels different, huh? She calls a friend. What do you think of this? I mean, is this a fake? Well, it doesn't feel like paper. That's, what do they call that? That's vellum. That feels like sheepskin. Well, it must be. I mean, it's old, or it's just a really good copy of making it feel old. She decides, you know, I should probably check this out. So she goes into Chicago with this under her arm, and she goes into an appraiser and says, hey, I have this. She unrolls it, and the appraiser about wets his pants, says, I've never seen one in this condition before. What is it? Apparently one of the original copies, handwritten, of the Declaration of Independence. But other than that, no big deal. Now, I cannot find the story to say if it is one of the original 13 or if it was original, one of the original, I think they were called stone copies. I can't remember the one that, the reason why the Declaration of Independence is so faint you can barely read it is two reasons. One, they hung it up in a window for years so everybody could see it before they realized, oh, I need some UV blocking here on the windows. Mm. So it faded. But the other reason is they wanted to make a copy of the actual Declaration of Independence. And so they hired a guy about, I think it was 1820, to go in and take a solvent and put it all on top of the Declaration of Independence and then lay another piece of vellum down onto the Declaration of Independence and then press it really hard and then slowly peel it off. And it actually took the ink off of the original Declaration of Independence. So it was an exact copy.
Wow.
And then they took that and they made an engraving. And there are only, I think, 100 copies that were made of that. Mercury One has one of those copies, I believe. They're about $50,000. So at worst, she's got a $50,000 copy. But I think, from what I'm reading in this, it was one of the original 13 because they were... Every state had a copy of it, but many of them, somehow or another, lost. They're like, where did I put that breakaway document?
What are you getting for one of those, 20, 25?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't even imagine.
It was one of the original copies that had the directions to the treasure on the back of it.
Right.
Has that. Oh, and you need the glasses. Okay. And Nicolas Cage strangely has to be there.
Yeah, they did find that. I saw a documentary on it. Yeah.
Okay. How much was that one worth?
Oh, my God. Well, they found the treasure, which was really the important part.
Yeah, but no, I saw another documentary.
Wasn't the treasure worth like $10 billion
or
something?
Yeah, it was. We don't have a debt anymore. I don't know why everybody keeps talking about this debt that we have. Anyway.
Can you imagine, if it was an original copy.
Oh, man.
What must that be? You couldn't even put a price on that. That'd be priceless.
You couldn't. How much was the...
Millions of dollars.
How much was the copy... What was it? The constitutional copy, the little book of the Constitution that was used by George Washington that had his handwriting in it. That was, what, $5-10 million? Remember that sold? $10 million? What would an original copy of the Declaration of Independence cost?
And would you be duty-bound to just give it to the government?
No.
And say, here?
No.
That's what they'd probably tell you.
That's exactly what they would tell you. No.
That's
the
ours.
The answer is no.
That's ours.
No. No, it's not. Now, here's the lesson I get, because there's also another story that came out of London last week. I don't know if you guys saw this, of the piano.
Yes.
Somebody buys a piano at a garage sale. They give it to a school, and it's a school of music. They're trying to tune this piano, and it's like, kank, kank, every time they hit these keys, and it's like, there's something blocking this, so the guy comes in to tune it. He can't get it tuned right, so he takes off the back, and in the back, hidden in the back of the piano, are literal bags of gold. And these bags of gold, one bag held like 3 coins that there are only 10 known in the world. I mean, lots of money sitting in the back of the piano. Now, here's what I would just like to say. This is why
you tell at least one member of your family,
by the way, I've hidden a copy of the Declaration of Independence in the dresser drawer upstairs.
In our sock drawer. I mean, so when I take the socks out of it, you might want to get the copy of the Independence.
How did that get lost in a family?
I don't know.
I would love to go back and find out. I'd like to go find out about the bedroom furniture and find out who owned the bedroom furniture.
Yeah.
How did they get this Declaration of Independence? But more importantly, how did they forget they had it?
It was probably owned by the Gates family. And they'd been doing that for a really long time, and they forgot.
Yeah. It's not a documentary.
Once you tell someone, it's no longer safe.
Right.
Right?
And the couple that had it before, they had it for a long time. With their family.
The furniture?
They got it for the piano. Not the furniture, but the piano. Okay. They had it for a long time in their home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With their kids growing
up. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And apparently they never played it, right?
Yeah, they plunked around at it. And then finally he was like, just get rid of this thing. And so it was there for a long time before, for nothing.
Yeah.
Just collecting dust.
No, but here's the thing on the Declaration of Independence. Because I've thought about this a lot. Because, if you had, let's just say you go into a situation where.
Because you do collect.
I do collect.
Artifacts.
Right. And I have thought about if we go into some kind of civil war, I wouldn't want those documents. I want those buried someplace. You know what I mean? I don't want to be responsible for them. I want to put them in a vault someplace and bury them, God forbid, if something would tragically break out in the country. So I haven't done any of this, and I can't do it now because I'm going to tell you about it on the air. But I thought, you at least tell members of your family, hey, we've buried something or I've hid something somewhere in the house and I've given, your mom one clue and you have the other piece or, whatever. You don't just hide it and then keep it to yourself.
Yeah, but if you had something that you thought was going to cause harm to your family, if found out that you had it, you wouldn't tell them.
I would sell it.
Right?
If it was the Declaration of Independence.
You'd want it to go to somebody who would treasure it as much as you do.
Yeah, and you wouldn't take something like the Declaration of Independence and roll it up and put it in the back of a drawer. Why? It's the Declaration of Independence. If you have it, if you have it legally and you're afraid of it, A, put it in a safe. B, donate it on loan to a museum. I mean, what do you do?
Smithsonian comes to mind.
How many times have we seen, we've seen this going back to horrible dictatorships, to religious theocracies where people did hide their important documents away from what they thought could come. People were afraid that if they threw it into a museum or a safe, people might look there. Right, so they put it in places where people wouldn't look if things went wrong. I mean,
it's just bizarre.
It is bizarre in the United States where you wouldn't think of that.
Nobody knew about it. Nobody in the family, because your children know how you feel about your artifacts, right?
And
hopefully, if you died, what to do with them?
Yeah.
So
it's like you were telling me about that one really invaluable document that you hid.
Blah 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 blah.
It had nothing to do with 3 degrees off the polar star. What?
That was a weird.
I was just saying it's not, nor five.
Okay.
Okay. Not
right.
Three nor five.
Huh.
Anyway, let's go someplace else. Talking about original things. Let me switch gears to frauds. Now this is really early technology, but for a version one of this technology to come out and to be this good is stunning. What this is a new algorithm, and they say it's artificial intelligence, but I don't think it's artificial intelligence, because if it is, it's just really bad artificial intelligence. It supposedly can mimic any voice.
And it does sound like the voice. The problem is he still can't get the inflection.
And that's why I think it's not artificial intelligence.
Yeah, because it doesn't know what the words mean. It's just spitting them out.
Right. So once artificial intelligence can really kick in and it knows what the sentence means and it knows.
Then you're onto something.
How that person would present it. It's pretty amazing. But I've said before, there's going to come a time when you're not going to believe photographs. We're already there.
Now you're not going to be able to believe your ears either. Listen to this. This is an algorithm that is reproducing Barack Obama's voice, Donald Trump's voice, and Hillary Clinton's voice. Get past the point that it sounds like a computer today and understand that that'll probably be taken care of in about 6 minutes.
Right. And these people didn't say these things. That's the most important part. This is just typed into a computer.
And it is spitting them back saying these words. These are not clipped. This is completely new generation of a voice.
Hey, Don, have you heard about this new technology?
Are you speaking about this new algorithm to copy voices?
Yes, it is developed by a startup called Wirebird.
This is huge. It can make us say anything now, really anything.
The good news is that they will offer the technology to anyone.
This is huge. How does their technology work?
Hey guys, I think that they use deep learning and artificial neural networks.
Hillary is right, and I can tell you that their team is great.
I wish them good luck. I'm sure they will do a good job.
I mean,
that's amazing.
The voices in the vicinity
sound,
already.
Yeah, the voices sound pretty close.
Barack Obama just is the stunning. Delivery.
Yeah,
stunning how close that one is.
Yeah.
Notice they can't get the computer to say huge.
Yeah,
it's just huge.
Yeah.
Also, if you listen, I was just listening with my earpiece in, and I heard it earlier on a speaker. So I don't know if anybody else heard this, but especially with Barack Obama, it's interesting because at the beginning, you almost can't understand the word. It's almost just like a tone.
Yeah.
Did you notice that? Yeah. It's just. Mm-hmm. It's how your ear. It shows you how your ear is almost like processing images and light. It's just processing all this sound, and it's making it. You're filling in the gaps.
You know what's happening? You are seeing the Matrix. You can see it. That's what's happening. Your whole world is changing. You can now see the little...
Guys, I think you need to learn the difference between movies and documentaries. This is the
we could talk
second
about that
one
later.
Here in a few minutes.
But, I mean, can we play it one more time? Because it's incredible.
It's stunning.
Hey, Don, have you heard about this new technology?
Are you speaking about this new algorithm to copy voices?
Yes, it is developed by a startup called Wirebird.
This is huge. It can make us say anything now, really anything.
The good news is that they will offer the technology to anyone.
This is huge. How does their technology work?
Hey guys, I think that they use deep learning and artificial neural networks.
Hillary is right, and I can tell you that their team is great.
I wish them good luck. I'm sure they will do a good job.
Hillary is the worst of the three. I wonder if they're having a harder time with women's voices.
I don't know. Sarah, can you play the, I don't know if this will throw the computers off. Can you play the, you know, return in 45 seconds? Can you play that?
Oh, she has
Sarah in our control room, because this is technology that's probably 10 years old, ancient, that we've had, that is artificial voice. And you listen to the difference, and 10 years ago, it sounds better than this does. But this is
mimicking
a specific voice, mm-hmm. and you can hear. I mean, they really have Hillary's even breathiness.
Well, even
hey,
when
hang
you,
on, here's
45 seconds.
That's a computer, and that's 10 years old.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sound anything like this. Imagine.
Sounds better.
Yeah. Imagine how difficult this is and where they're taking it.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
All right, a couple things we want to cover. We've got a great second half hour for you. You don't want to miss coming up in just a few minutes. Something about Donald Trump that is quite amazing. Plus the cost of living and, you know, buying a new house today. We'll get into that here in just a second. Soda tax.
Yeah, Santa Fe, New Mexico voted on the soda tax, and they rejected it.
Nice.
Santa Fe.
Nice move.
For Santa Fe, that is huge.
I think that's a fairly liberal area, isn't it? Santa Fe, New Mexico?
Yeah.
Yeah, capital cities usually are.
Yeah, no, but Santa Fe is beyond a capital. It's almost a little mini San Francisco far as its progressiveness.
Hmm. But, I mean, maybe they've seen what it's done to Philadelphia.
Oh, my God, it's been terrible for Philadelphia, but 57 to 43, so not even that close. One of the things they tried to do was make it a 2 cent per ounce tax on drinks.
2 cents an ounce?
Yeah, so 40 cents on a, $2 bottle of soda for individual serving. It's a big. I mean, they keep saying 2 cents per ounce because they don't want to tell you the percentage.
Yeah.
Which is a 25% tax or a 20% tax on these sodas.
Wow.
But at least it was a reasoned debate. People lined up outside of voting booths dressed as Muppets because this money would have gone to pre-K.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
So people dressed as Muppets to convince people.
You got to be kidding me.
It's always for the children.
And yet, debt, saying cut all of this crazy spending is not about the children somehow or another. You hate children if you want to cut it. No, I want my children to be able to be debt-free. I want my children to have choices in front of them. If it's true that Donald Trump and Barack Obama made pretty much the same choices because of what George Bush said to me, when you sit behind this chair, you're going to realize you have very few choices. It's because of debt. It's because you are owned part and parcel by someone else. And that someone else is debt. Whoever controls the debt, you're not free to make choices.
It's horrifying.
That's
why
about,
do you hate the children?
No, that's about the children. I
you hate the
should
children,
watch the documentary.
Glenn.
This is about the
what kind
children.
Of freak would hate the children?
Well, watch the documentary, Dave. So you'll see how that worked out.
It's pretty horrifying.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Small Wonder, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. We were just talking about that great classic TV show, Small Wonder.
Oh, the documentary?
Oh, she is fantastic. We were wondering where she was hidden, but she's with the Fatima kids. Noah's Ark, they're on the 39th parallel, which is not to be confused
with
by the 38th parallel, which has something to do with North Korea.
And a demilitarized zone.
And also made popular, first, of course, by Billy Joel. Okay, so
I mean, that goes without saying. I don't even know why you say
yeah.
it.
Right.
And then, I mean, our generation, that's why you know it. The last generation knew it because of the actual Korean War, but we knew it because of we didn't start the fire, right? Right? And that, I mean,
probably.
Yeah.
That probably had something to do with it.
Yeah, it could have. I'm just saying. 39th parallel, secret parallel, where Small Wonder is hiding right now. We were just talking about whether you buy a house, and I'm only torturing Stu every day because he's about to buy a house, and I just keep telling him.
I don't know that, but
don't buy a house.
Seems like I might.
Yeah, just don't buy a
and
house.
And you just keep saying, don't do it.
No, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't buy a house.
I don't think that's...
Sell your house. Don't buy a house.
I can't sell my house. I haven't bought it yet.
Right. Well, you should buy it and then sell it.
I'm a big fan of renting, as you know.
Yeah. You know what? I'm in exactly the same situation, and I'm so torn. You know, Tanya, I want to sell the house, and I want to sell the house because I want to downsize.
One of those tiny houses? So what you want to
not get? That tiny. Stop. Although, can I tell you something? Can I tell you something? My kids still, they all sleep in our room. They don't sleep in our bed, but they all sleep in our room.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Ours they too. Still they still come down in the middle
sleep
of the night.
Chairs,
you know. Where we all, you know, we just, honestly, it's, yep. I know, but they're not sleeping together. It's not a weird
thing. No, I didn't, that was not where I was going. I just, they're how old?
40.
40? I mean, that seems old to be sleeping in your bedroom.
Well, it's uncomfortable when they're trying to procreate with their spouses.
Yeah.
But we just,
start this with it.
We're
wasn't
close
weird.
Family.
Other than that, it's fine.
That's weird to you?
So that's how it is in their family.
No,
who
I mean,
are you, Stu, to cast aspersions on that.
Yeah, it's fair.
Who are you? Yeah.
Contemporary family. We learned that earlier on the program today.
Here's how crazy the housing market is right now in Texas. My daughter and son-in-law are about to buy a house, and they were looking at this beautiful house. I think it was $155,000, but it had a lot of upgrades. It was kind of small, like 1,800 square feet.
I was going to say, it's got to be in Texas. Yeah. That's got to be a 5-square-foot house.
But it's beautiful with all the upgrades that you would expect in a house. $500,000. Mm-hmm. And so they went to look at it, loved it, put an offer in at 165,
ten
like
over.
10,000 over. They didn't get the house. The bid that won was $175,000.
Wow.
20,000 over.
See, this is what makes me concerned.
Buy high, sell low, right?
No, that's the way I usually do it.
Okay.
Here's what makes me really concerned. You know, I live in a town that, you know, is in a higher tax bracket, and so there's some pretty spectacular houses. I'm telling you, houses that I thought were spectacular 3 years ago look like tiny houses.
Yeah.
We went for a Sunday drive this last Sunday.
Yes.
And honestly, we saw three houses that we said, where the hell does that one stop?
It doesn't stop. They don't.
I saw a house that just kept going and going. Honestly, we were driving on the street. And
I believe you're talking about.
No.
When you say, I want to sell my house and downsize, I look at those homes and go, that's the downsizing.
You know what? We have a house. You know, our ranch is, like 1,800 square feet. We love it. We absolutely love it. Because the family is always together. I mean, it's not great when you're like, get out of my face. If somebody has is having a really bad day, not a good house.
Yeah.
Not a good house. But for when you're all getting along, that's just great. And we love being close together. And some of these houses that they're building now are huge. And, you know, you'll be like, oh, it's a family of three. What do they each have 18,000 square feet? What's in that house?
There's a house they've been building for like 18 years, I think, because they just keep adding new sections to it that is fairly close to us. And you just think, what do you people do for a living? How big a house? Honestly. What is this, a Ronald McDonald house?
It's
How huge. Big does this clown need his house to be?
It's not the only one, man.
I live down the street from one of the guys who is the chairman of the board of the train, you know, one of the big trains. So, you're...
They're big trains now?
Yeah, the big trains. Okay. So, you know, it's a guy who's pulling down some coinage.
Some cash, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of shipping goes on in the country.
Yeah, there's a big shipping area here in the Southwest. And he's like the president or chairman of the board or something. And he's got a large house.
Pretty nice place.
He's got a large house. We drive by and we're like, wow, that's a large house. You go, you know, six blocks away from him, and I'm telling you, you look at him and say, this must be where Jesus lives, because I know this guy who I can't relate to on how much cash he's making. I know what his house looks like. Who lives here? The entire Holy Family? What is this house?
I think Jesus has a smaller house.
But the camels, you got to keep camels, you have to have sheep, you don't want the sheep and the camels mixing.
What, he only has half a basketball court, not a full basketball court?
Okay, so
I looked at the documentary, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
No, again, learn the difference between a movie and a documentary.
Right.
May I go here? Cost of living, how much did a house cost in 1924?
Not
a new car was $275.
Really?
Yeah, wow. Sorry, $265.
Wow.
Your average rent was $18 a month, and tuition to Harvard, for a full year was $250.
Mm.
How much was a house?
$2,000.
Yeah, that had to be close.
Okay, this shows you the run up of the Roaring Twenties. A new house was $7,720.
Wow, that's from the Sears catalog.
Wow,
I don't know. That's the average house. So now in 1938. How much was a new house?
During the Depression, probably considerably less.
Harvard tuition had gone up to $420. A new car was $860.
Wow.
Mm. A new house, $3,900.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. You go to 1943, it's $3,600.
Jeez.
So you held on to your house. You had to hold on to your house because you couldn't sell it. You were taking a bath. You didn't get back up to a $9,000 house till 1952. Mm. In 52, tuition to Harvard University was $600. A new car was $1,700. Let me skip ahead here. Let's go to 1962. A new house was $12,000. So you've gone from 1924 to 1962.
Pretty stable.
Pretty stable, except for the Depression where it went down. You've gone from $7,000 to $12,000. Okay? In 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
1962, cost of a new house is $12,000. A new car is $2,900. Tuition to Harvard is $1,500. Now let's go to 1973. Let's go to 1971. A new house has gone in 9 years. A new house has gone from $12,000 to $25,000. Yeah. Your car has gone to $3,500. And your Harvard tuition has gone to $2,600 a year. Okay. From in 1927 or 1924, $250 a year to go to Harvard, to now in 1971, $2,600. Here's where it gets interesting. Remember, 1971, a house was $2,500. How much was a house in 1978?
If it acted the way it did during the Depression, we were in a serious recession.
No way, though.
So you would think maybe it went down again?
Because in 78, they were still, they weren't building as much.
Remember, double incomes.
Yeah, they, it was
the double incomes had just started back in the early 70s.
Mom and Dad, it was okay for mom to work.
Yep, yep.
So they so had, your house, had to go up.
Your house went from, in 61 or 63, 12,000 to 71, 25,000.
So it doubled.
To 1978, to 54,000.
Yeah, doubled again.
Your cost in 1983 has gone to 82,000.
Wow.
A new car is now 8,500. Ticket tuition to Harvard is now $8,100. It had gone from 250 to 1,500 to now 8,000. What happened? The government started guaranteeing tuitions. Then in 1999, a new house, 131,000, a new car, 21,000, and tuition to Harvard, $31,000 per year.
And now it's what, 60, 50, or 60,000 a year?
Yeah, I don't have anything past 99.
Wow.
I mean, one of the things, if you remember, go back to the 2007 era before the housing collapse happened, and you were making the arguments on the air all the time that this stuff was going to occur. You're giving me some weird eye signal, so I don't know what that means.
No, I'm just, okay. I'm just listening.
You're just
to
pleased
you.
With yourself. I got it.
No, no, no. I'm just listening to you.
No, but one of the things you based that on was the Case-Shiller Index. It was one of the big pieces of data that you found to be incredibly problematic because it controls for things like inflation. These numbers obviously are partially inflation, partially the housing market going up. It's tough to break those things out.
Yeah, and now nothing. You can't look at anything like Case-Shiller. You can't look at anything anymore because nothing's real. Because the Fed has dumped money, because we've printed money, you don't know if is the stock market real? Is the housing price real? You don't know. Nothing is based on truly free market principles.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot of complication there, which is, I think, what you're getting at. But, I mean, it's still an interesting thing to look
it
at.
It is, it is.
So, in between, so it's basically 100 is like your average of the Case-Shiller Index for basically the entire time. So it ranged between 80 and 120 the entire time. It's kind of just measuring how overinflated housing prices are.
And 100 is, let's, I don't remember how it works.
Normal. Let's normal. Say normal is 100. So it ranged between 80 and 120
for how many years?
1880 to 2000. Okay.
1880 to 2000.
The only exception to that was the Great Depression, where it was a little bit under 80. But it was basically between there the entire time between 1880 and 2000.
And this is on the Kay Jewelers
This is Case-Shiller or Schiller.
Schiller.
Okay,
yeah.
Schiller.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Who have we talked to?
We've had Schiller.
I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah, we've had one of them on. Really, really bright. This is as scientific as you can get on housing.
Yes. So between 80 and 120 for 120 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. The housing crisis peaks in 2005.
Yeah.
It hits almost 200. So it's double normal. Jeez, goes, I mean, it had never even come close to that in its history. And then you have the housing collapse, right? We all remember the big inflation and the housing collapse. And finally, we're getting back. We're getting back. Sure. That's not the story the Case-Shiller Index tells at all. It went from about 120 at the beginning of the housing bubble up to 200. And then it dropped. The bubble popped and it came back down to 120.
still the highest level.
So it was still at the highest level it had been in 120 years.
Oh my
was
gosh.
The end of the crisis.
Well,
it has now reached back up to 160.
Jeez.
Oh my gosh.
From 120 to 160 again.
And I tell you,
again.
the only place that to me makes any sense at all is Texas. Because the people are moving to Texas. The influx of people here is just outrageous.
You
how
see the
fast it's growing.
Apartments they're building.
Oh, and they pop up fast and they're all sold. I mean, it's just so fast because people are moving here. Everywhere else, what is happening in your town that is causing this big bubble?
I didn't even see that mentioned in the K-Jeweler Index.
Yeah, it's not K-Jeweler again.
I think that's why people go to Jared.
Glenn Beck Program.
888-727-BACK.
Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Ken LaCourte wrote a great article. Fox News insider, growing and troubling realization that James Murdoch is in charge. He said, I worked at the channel as a senior manager for nearly 20 years, blah, blah, blah. Ran FoxNews.com as a senior VP. He writes an amazing story about how this is a hit job. He said it was hard for people at the network who looked up to Roger to see that go. But, you know, but Bill O'Reilly, that's a hit. And what they're doing now, it looks just like a smear campaign and a hit job.
Someone should develop a subscription service that could compete with Fox News that had a conservative...
Hey, I saw a documentary about the blaze.com/TV.
Really?
You should go there and subscribe.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.